we've always kind of been like, just put us in as many buckets as you can. You know, we're just a bunch of friends that have been playing together for 20 years, having the time of our lives still 20 years later, you know. But like, once you see us, I think most people would come back.
Greetings, friends. Keith Billick here. Thank you so much for joining me. Are you looking for a podcast where you can hear about playing the banjo, banjo music, banjo stories, all from the world's top banjo players? I have great news. You have found the correct podcast. This is the Picky Fingers Banjo Podcast, brought to you by our friends at Peghead Nation, Elderly Instruments, Page Capos, and Sullivan Banjos. Like I said, I am Keith Billick, and I will be your tour guide for this part of your banjo journey. I do have one quick, exciting announcement before we get started. If you want to learn banjo directly from me in person, I've been hired to be on the faculty this year for the Midwest Banjo Camp. That's happening this June 6th through 9th over in Manchester, Indiana. Head over to MidwestBanjoCamp.com. The list of instructors is just insane. There's way too many for me to list, but suffice to say, I am probably the least impressive instructor on that list. You will be quite impressed. And for those of you who can make it, make sure you come say hi to me while we're there. And whether you are going to the Midwest Banjo Camp or any other banjo camp or banjo festival, bluegrass festival or event, or if you're just walking down the street in your town, the best way to identify yourself as someone of the utmost sophistication and high culture is to wear your official Picky Fingers logo merchandise, which all of that can be found at banjopodcast.com. You can get your official Picky Fingers t-shirts, hats, stickers, hoodies, all that stuff. So yeah, check it out, banjopodcast.com. I have cool colors in all sorts of sizes. So yeah, get yourself ready for the festival season. And perhaps the best way to support the show is to become a VIP, a very important picker listener. And today's VIP listener of the show is Tom Donovan. Tom, thank you so much for your generous support of the podcast. I truly appreciate it. How do you become a VIP listener, you might wonder? Well, I'll tell you what, it's by going to my Patreon site, which is patreon.com/banjopodcast. I know I'm throwing a lot of websites at you, but they're all in the show notes too. So yeah, patreon.com/banjopodcast. How it works is you sign up to throw just a few measly dollars per month my way, and it does go directly to support the show. It makes a huge difference. So Tom Donovan and the rest of the VIP listeners really appreciate it. And if none of those things are quite your style, there are other ways to support the show that don't involve any money. Like this podcast actually gets published to YouTube, for example. So that does help when you watch it on YouTube. There's really nothing to watch. It's still just the audio track. But hitting the like and subscribe, if that's what you're doing, that all helps with the, you know, the old algorithm. So if you want to be a part of the quest for banjo world domination, those are all good ways to do it. And don't forget to email me directly, pickyfingersbanjopodcast@gmail.com. I've been driving on this road from home. I barely know. I've been driving for so long that this road might be my home. Today's featured guest is Kevin Kniebel, the banjoist and a vocalist with the Minneapolis-based band Pertnir Sandstone. Now, at first glance, Pertnir Sandstone seems like one of those hard-driving, energetic, foot-stomping types of old-time bands, but they are a bit more than that. They really pull from some of the Jamgrass sensibilities, like some creative, multi-influential songwriting, cool arrangements, and featuring multiple singers and songwriters. So it all gets blended together to give them a really cool, unique sound. And Kevin, being a great banjo player, is of course the driving force behind a lot of that, which you will hear about right now. So give a warm Picky Fingers welcome to Kevin Knievel.
How I found my way to the banjo, I guess, was by a process of elimination. I was in this band with my high school friends, and other people wanted to sing songs, and so that meant I'd either have to play an instrument or stand there looking dumb. And so we were at a bluegrass festival, and we kind of saw all the banjos around. We realized we didn't have one in our band. We weren't really even a old-time inspired modern string band yet, which is maybe what we are now. But I was like, well, nobody's playing the banjo yet. How hard could it be? And it was pretty hard.
Wait, so the band you were in high school, was that the early stages of Pert Near Sandstone? I know you guys have been around for a while.
Well, I probably said that in a confusing way, but we started, I was probably about 24 when the band got together, but it was with friends that I had had since high school.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, we'd known each other for over a decade already when the band started. So.
Wow. Amazing. So you said you weren't already a progressive old-time band or whatever. Were you an acoustic band, or is this a rock and roll band?
No, we were an acoustic band, yeah. So we, two of the guys that were in the band to start, one, the guitar player's name is Jay Lenz, and our original fiddle player's name is Ryan Young, who is now in Trampled by Turtles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'd all known each other since we were real young. And I had a job that was keeping me really busy, and my boss told me that I needed to find a hobby. And so these guys, I was living with Jay, and, you know, I had like this idea that if we got like a 12 pack, they had one free night that they weren't already practicing with other bands. And so every, I don't know if it was a Tuesday or a Wednesday, but for, you know, almost a year, every Tuesday we were playing old, like, Garcia Grissman, Bob Dylan, you know. Then we started to play like more new folk music. And then Nate Sipe, who was the fiddle and mandolin player, showed up not too long after the three of us, you know, got together, maybe a time or two without him. And he ran into somebody, one of those two guys at a party, and he's like, "You're playing folk music and you didn't invite me." So he had been hopping trains all over like Canada and the upper Pacific Northwest area. And he took a mandolin with him and kind of learned how to play mandolin. And so he showed up a really, really big fan of the New Lost City Ramblers. And so we kind of, for a long time, were just, you know, doing that folk music and playing lots of New Lost City Ramblers songs, which was really fun. And yeah, just it kind of grew from there. You know, you get interested in a certain style of music, and then you get really kind of do the deep dive and figure out like, where'd this come from and who do I like? And
yeah, start to connect all the dots of what you're hearing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of feel like it was a pretty, like many things in my life, unplanned, and yet couldn't have worked out any better, you know? So
you said you came to it by process of elimination. Does that mean that it seemed like every other instrument had been accounted for other than banjo? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, we had a bass player, we had a guitar player, we had a mandolin player, we had a fiddle player, and I played guitar, but I wasn't, you know, any good at it. And so I was like, well, maybe I can figure out the banjo. And I did try to learn three-finger style for almost a full year, took lessons and everything, and wasn't up to a point where I felt like I could get anywhere near a stage letting anyone knew I play the banjo. And so I was going to give it up, actually. But the mandolin player in our band was working at a guitar shop, and he said, "Hey, there's this guy that teaches people this other style banjo. You should come check it out." And, you know, I had a pretty good chord vocabulary from failing to learn the three-finger style for almost a year. and you know, I think it was like, you know, on a Thursday I had a lesson, and we had a show like the next day or the day after, and I was playing the banjo on stage. So it just kind of, I was like, huh, this actually
makes
sense.
In a clawhammer style.
Yeah.
Wow. Tell me more about this festival that you said you went to that seemed to be pivotal in some way for you.
Yeah, there's a great old time and bluegrass community in Minnesota, you know, old time bands, bluegrass bands and related bands all kind of together in this community. It's called Mbatma, which is, you know, Minnesota Bluegrass and Old Time Music Association. And they put on four festivals a year in the Minnesota area, two in the summer, one in the winter and one in the fall.
Okay.
And, you know, we were like, wow, we got all this resource right around us when we first got interested in this music. It's like all these people playing these traditions, you know, and we were like, hey, we like camping. What if we went to this camping festival? So, you know, if we've never been to a camping bluegrass festival. We've been to other kind of camping festivals, you know, where there's lots of music and late night mischief. But we were like, oh, the mischief here is you just stay up until the sun comes up playing bluegrass. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. Do you remember like certain acts that you saw that inspired you, or was it just kind of like the community in general that was inspiring?
Yeah, you know, I would say that festival, we were really lucky. We kind of on a whim decided to go. And then on a whim decided to go to the dance tent at a certain time, and just getting real fired up was the Wilders. You ever heard that band?
Sure, yeah.
And oh my, they just blew our hair back, and Betsy Ellis on the fiddle, and just the whole crew of them playing. It was old time honky tonk and western swing, you know, it was kind of their thing, and they were just the best at it. And we'd been playing in little coffee shops, you know, with like a tree of microphones around us, you know, and we were like, well, what are they doing around just that one microphone? What's about to happen here? Like, where's the rest of the microphones? And we were kind of like, oh, and that's how it's supposed to be done. You know, they were just working that one mic and so much energy and really like high octane old time stuff. You know, she is like the fieriest fiddler around.
Yeah, they're like the perfect dance tent band.
Oh man, that's so
from
great.
All the energy that they have, yeah.
Yeah, and like I think, you know, the next week or whatever, we went out, we waited after, and we're like, well, what model of microphone is that? We were the proud owner of a AT4033, I think, like the next week, you know. We're like, let's do it. That'll be fun to figure that out. And it's kind of been a part of our stage act anyway ever since. You know, we eventually kind of, because of where we were playing, maybe the time of night we were playing, et cetera, the kind of people that are coming out to see us, it didn't really make any sense to just play around microphones anymore. So we had to figure out how to get a lot louder. So we like plugged in, and, you know, we have all kinds of different method of, kind of sound reinforcement in the band, but we still kind of preserve that one microphone dynamic, you know? So for a long time, just until after COVID, now we have two mics on stage, even though there's four singers, you know, so
they've multiplied.
COVID protocol.
So were you, since you, however you put it, came into it by process of elimination, I guess it might be understandable if you weren't really that inspired, but it seems like at this point you've become inspired by the banjo. Did that bug bite you like right away? Were you getting into, you know, diving in and learning how to play? And what did you do after that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was into banjo before that. I think a lot of people that came to the music the way I came to the music, maybe their first banjo player that they heard was Jerry Garcia. That was probably not mine, but it's the first one I remember. I grew up listening to classic country, so I definitely was exposed to a lot of banjo as a kid. You know, my first concert was a Willie Nelson concert. And I mean, I remember all that kind of growing up as being kind of a big deal. But the three-finger style, like, I really got into it when I heard Old and In the Way. But like I say, I was not able to figure out how to do that. From there, once I learned about the clawhammer, I was like, well, I wonder what I could get into as it relates to that, you know? And I had a friend who had been, you know, on the scene for a long time, and had met these guys, had spent some time in Colorado, met these guys in a band called High on the Hog.
Oh, yeah.
You ever know that band?
Yeah, yeah. I knew that. Are you familiar? Was the fiddler's name Brian Roman when you knew them?
Oh.
Or at all? Or
no. I mean,
he's a friend of mine, and he was in there, but
yeah. He's the name is familiar, but the ones that I was, you know, it might have been Brian and then Ryan, right? And then Kurt. Yeah,
I don't know any of the others. He was just a Michigan guy who ended up out there.
I got you. Yeah, Ryan Spearman, who I think is now in St. Louis, maybe. And anyway, Kurt Alsobrook, I think, was a lot of those guys could play multiple instruments, but I think Kurt Alsobrook was the main banjo player, I think. Okay. But anyway, I got into them just on archive.org. I mean, somebody was like, you know, I can't find the record in print anywhere, but they've got, you know, 40 shows on archive.org. And so I just was like, you know, everywhere I went, I was listening to those MP3s. It's this great, crisp, driving, you know, old-time Clarimer style, which I loved. And that's kind of what really bit me, was listening to that band.
So it seems like, yeah, between being inspired by the Wilders and High on the Hog and just kind of what you've said, is that really the thing that gets you off about the banjo, is that hard drive and upbeat kind of style?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I will say that I really appreciate and like love people who play more melodic and delicate clawhammer, but no one would accuse me of that, I don't think.
There's still time.
I hope so. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I get most excited about like, yeah, that real foot stomp. And, you know,
from a player's standpoint, is there a way that you are able to work on that, or would maybe recommend other people working on it to achieve that kind of sound?
You mean like the drive?
Yeah. Yeah. If other people who are listening want to achieve that, how would you suggest they approach that?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think a lot of it, at the beginning anyway, felt like it was in my setup. Like I wanted to play harder than my body would allow me to, cause I would like, you know, I'd be bleeding a lot. But I get a fake nail put on, at a salon, like every 3 or 4 weeks. They just get
like
just
an acrylic.
One. Yep. Just an acrylic. Yep.
Okay.
And, yeah, probably for, you know, 13, 14 years now, I've had one on, mostly on this finger. I started with my middle finger, when I first started playing clawhammer. And I don't know why. Somebody said it didn't matter. And so I was like, okay, well, I'll use my middle finger. And then it started to feel like it did matter, and that the index finger was better. So I switched to that.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean,
and how often does each nail that? Like, how often do you have to go back
this
in
nail,
there?
This nail, like,
that?
It's already grown out about 4 millimeters. And I got to put it on probably like a week and a half ago or something like that. 2 weeks ago, maybe. And they still work as long as they don't, you know, you can just file them down until. I probably, you know, I could go every 2 weeks, but I typically go every month and a half.
Got it.
It's like now, $5. So it's like, you know, it's really, oh, yeah.
Even on a banjo player's income,
yeah,
like that's seriously kind of affordable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I just like come in at odd hours at this neighborhood place, and I just give them, I just tip them nicely, and they just are like, oh, just one. Come here. You can sneak in ahead of this lady. So that's nice.
Perfect. Remind me what town you're in right now?
Minneapolis, yeah. So Minneapolis, okay. That's kind of another part of, I think, what kind of drove me to play the banjo, is that there's so much folk music in Minneapolis and the West Bank scene, you know, where folks like Spider John Kerner and you know, Powder Milk Biscuit Jug Band, and like, you know, the West Bank folk music that was probably most made famous on the Prairie Home Companion, but also through, like, you know,
sure,
like I say, Spider John and, you know, Bob Dylan obviously came through that scene for a hot minute too. But yeah, there's a rich folk tradition still here. My wife, for example, is in a dancing troupe that does clog dancing. And it's it's Appalachian clog dancing, like, you know, kind of square dance formations. I guess they call it precision clogging or something, but they've been a thing since like the early 80s, you know, and it's still a group here. So it's like the legacy of, it's like an institution, you know, the folk music community in Minneapolis. So anyway,
that's so great. Yeah.
Yeah. I got a lesson once from a guy who's really well loved around here, named Bill Hinckley, who's wonderful, multi-instrumentalist, brilliant guy. And so somebody said, you really got to take a lesson with Bill. And so I went over to his house, and, you know, just musical history, you know, kind of tucked away in every corner. And he's really nice, welcoming guy. And, you know, he's like, well, what do you know about the banjo? And I was like, honestly, not much, you know. Well, what do you want to learn today? I'm like, I don't know, maybe a tune or two. He's like, all right, well, if you don't know much, let's start at the beginning. And he basically said, we're going to take this whole thing apart and put it back together and make sure, you know, so like we totally deconstructed it, put it back together. He taught me one tune and sent me on my way.
What do you think the most important things that he taught you were that you maybe wouldn't have picked up on your own?
he's like a science guy, you know, so it was all about like tension. I mean, he just was much more methodical, you know, than I was just kind of like going to play it until it fall apart probably, you know, but he's like, no, you got to really understand where it's pulling on itself and how it, you know, what to look for to make sure it's in good shape. How do you know when you need to go get, you know, fret job, all that stuff. He kind of just was, you know, I feel like I learned a lot right there, but.
Well, speaking of that, before you started talking about the acrylic nail, you said a lot of getting the hard drive and sound was in the setup. And I thought you were going to talk about your banjo. You started talking about your nail.
Yeah.
But were you also meaning to say that it's in the banjo setup?
Yeah. Like I had to get, I think the thing I had is like a Kirshner tailpiece or something that put, you know, it came with a no knot and that wasn't going to work for me. So I've tried a bunch of those different tailpieces that put a lot of counter pressure and, you know,
were you pulling the strings off of the bridge or something? Is that what the problem was?
Yeah. Or just like, you know, it wasn't staying in tune and the bridge was moving and I'm like, you know, this wasn't pulling it off. It just was like, you know, felt like it wasn't, for as hard as I wanted to play it, it wasn't really,
just not stable
set up tight enough to, you know,
that makes sense.
I don't know. Maybe most people, don't have that problem, but I don't know. It came, it felt like it was not meant to be played. Like it wasn't meant to be taken out of the house.
Very delicate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. So did you end up discovering other players that you feel influenced you? And if so, who were those players and what do you think you got from them?
Yeah. I mean, I got into like a lot of different styles, I guess. You know, like I really fell in love with Doc Boggs early on. Like listening to that style and as much the singing as anything, which is I think how I come to music first anyways as a singer, but because I just, you know, that kind of grew, I feel like I came out of the womb singing, you know, and so I just like think about his approach to singing and the banjo and how eerie and awesome it was. And I grew up, I remember watching a lot of Hee Haw in my grandparents' house. And so like, once I realized what I was doing again and I was like, oh, that kind of feels connected to some stuff I did as a kid, went back and like got into string bean and stuff a little bit, you know, Roy Andrade is the guy's name in Real Time Travelers. Who I found because, you know, I'm a huge fan of Martha Scanlon's songwriting. And so the Real Time Travelers, you know, were a big band out of the Pacific North, or old time band out of the Pacific Northwest. I think for, you know, he in particular, I fell in love with this song of hers. It's called Seeds of the Pine, I think. And there's a really beautiful live recording of them.
Watermelon, you're a sweet, sweet smile. Listening
to it on YouTube, and I was still pretty early learning to play the banjo, and this guy plays just these beautiful lines, and I couldn't figure it out, you know, and I'm like, well, doesn't seem like he's tuned the same way as me, you know, like what, I can't figure out what's going on here. And so then I kind of messed around with it a little bit and I was like, oh, that's the thing. People play in a lot of different tunings in Clawhammer, you know? So like, maybe I need another lesson or two. So I went and got some more lessons, from a gentleman over at this place called the Homestead Pick and Parlor, which is another institution here in the Minneapolis area. It's in Richfield, actually, but it's a wonderful place, a great resource, lots of instruction and stuff. But anyway, hearing that song and wanting to like be able to play that way, I kind of feel like I came by it all honestly, you know, because like I've just been trying to keep up with my band, you know, which are like these friends of mine who are all, I feel like, considerably better musicians from where I started, you know? So I've been trying to keep pace and catch up. And
that's definitely a unique situation, almost being in the band before you know how to play, how to do what you're supposed to do in the band. Yeah, it just feels
very organic and weird, but, you know, like I feel like it's really worked for me anyway. I feel like I love like getting into like old time circles and playing tunes now. And I mean, like all the things that maybe people would experience, you know, first, I feel like I came too later, you know, but I'm like, oh, this is really sweet. I could do this the rest of my life.
And now a word from our sponsors, but we will be right back with the episode in just a few moments. The Picky Fingers podcast is thrilled to be sponsored by Peghead Nation, the top site for instructional video courses in banjo, guitar, mandolin, fiddle, dobro, upright bass, and ukulele. You're going to learn bluegrass, old time, and other styles from some of the most talented players and instructors in all of roots music. Go to pegheadnation.com to see their great lineup of courses. Here are some of the choices just for banjo. Beginning banjo and bluegrass banjo with Bill Evans, clawhammer banjo with Evie Layden, Wade Ward style banjo with Bruce Molsky, the banjo according to Danny Barnes, and contemporary bluegrass banjo with Wes Corbett. All of these courses include high-quality multi-angle video lessons, downloadable notation and tablature, play-along tracks, and plenty of tunes and songs to play. The best part is that just for being a Picky Fingers podcast listener, you are going to get your first month free. So head over to pegheadnation.com and use the promo code PickyFingers at checkout. That's pegheadnation.com and Picky Fingers, all one word, all lowercase, at checkout. I'm so proud to welcome a new sponsor to the podcast. That's Paige Capos. Paige has been family-owned right here in my home state of Michigan since Brian and Ralph Paige started the business way back in 1988. Since then, Paige has become known for its high-quality capos for all the instruments. And folks, they have three different lines of capos. So whether you are just figuring out how these things work, right on up to if you are a demanding studio or stage professional, Paige has a product for you. And just when you thought there couldn't possibly be anything new in the capo design world, they are proving that wrong with their new Paige Pro series. I can tell you firsthand that the innovative patented design on these new Paige Pro capos is second to none in both the tone quality, it sounds like you're not playing with a capo at all, and also the tuning stability. It's pretty amazing and you owe it to yourself to check them out. So head over to PaigeCapo.com. That's PaigeCapo.com. The Picky Fingers podcast is also sponsored by Elderly Instruments. I have been so lucky to have Elderly Instruments as my local family-owned music store for as long as I can remember. But they are more than just that. They are the world's most trusted source for new, used, and vintage fretted instruments, which means they're the first place you should check for any of your banjo, mandolin, guitar, ukulele needs, instructional materials, and all the accessories to go with it. And the other part is that Elderly is just as well known for their excellent customer service as for their amazing selection of products. So head over to elderly.com to see their full inventory or give them a call to talk to one of their helpful and professional sales representatives. That's 517-372-7880. And last but not least, we have another family-owned business in Sullivan Banjos supporting the Picky Fingers Banjo Podcast. A lot of you know that I have been playing my Sullivan Banjo for about 20 years now, and I'm here to tell you that it is sounding better than ever. Now, fortunately for you, Eric is still maintaining that high Sullivan quality, and he is ready, willing, and able to build you the banjo of your dreams, whether you just want a tried and true traditional design on up through your wildest custom dream banjo. Eric is here to build it for you. Head on over to sullivanbanjo.com, email sullivanbanjo@gmail.com, or just go the old-fashioned way. Call up Eric Sullivan at 502-365-5022. Get that legendary Sullivan tone with that added personal touch of being able to design your banjo with the person who's actually building it for you. So throughout all these different influences that you've had, is there anything that you feel is important that you've incorporated into like your own performing and playing or songwriting? Or I guess another way to ask it would be like, what do you consider some elements of like your personal style?
Yeah, I feel like the songs that I write on the banjo. And so, you know, like everything I write is kind of written for the band that I'm in, you know. It's kind of, I feel like that what's unique about it is that it is, as a band, I think we're one of the more eclectic string bands out there from the perspective of the fact that we have like four really different songwriters that all like to write songs and sing, and we love each other's work, and like we're, you know, it's very familial and supportive. And so in terms of like what from my style is incorporated into my writing, I feel like it's all been an experiment, you know? So like on the last record,
you were going exactly where I was going to ask. I was going to say like, maybe there's an example of like something you've written that you, developed on the banjo or something.
Yeah. On this last record, we recorded something that is like unlike anything I've ever done before. And it's definitely not a Charlie Poole inspired song whatsoever, you know, but like it got me thinking about his, you know, kind of two finger style. And, you know, I like I said, I haven't done anything like it before, but I felt like, oh, there's like there's something here that feels like there's a theme here. And like the words really came and felt important to me. And I just kind of was like, I think this needs to be on the record. And everybody was like, yeah, let's do it. It's different. It's beautiful. And, you know, we put a little bit of slide guitar on there, which there's a lot of slide on this latest record, but that's, you know, a newer thing for us too. And just like kind of, I feel like as we go along, we're like each record is like been another layer, you know what I mean? And there's like songs that the guitar player Jay writes where he's not really writing straight ahead, you know, folk tunes. He's got a lot of different varied influences, and like I've gotten a lot of opportunity to like figure out, well, what's my part going to be on this? Like, this isn't a normal Clawhammer song, you know, like how the heck is a Clawhammer player supposed to not just go take a break during this song, you know? And so it's opened a lot of, I think, weird doors that have been really fun to walk through and kind of learn. So I sometimes tell, especially like, you know, the fiddle and mandolin player that we play with, Nate Sipe, who he doesn't live in Minnesota anymore. You know, those were the days where we'd just like, hey, come on over, we'll play tunes, and you could just do that right in the living room. But now he flies in for shows. But, you know, back in the day, I'd say he was my most influential banjo teacher, you know, and he doesn't really play banjo. He'd just be like, no, I think that's not quite right. What if you did? And we'd just slow stuff down and work on it together. And like, all right, there we go. That's that tune. So
yeah. Anyway, a little more of an objective kind of listener to reflect
and to learn together, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Which has been fun. Anyway, I can do this little one for you if you want.
Yeah, of course.
It's called Lay Down Your Burdens. And I think I remember it. It goes something like this. Thank you. Just you, on when you're feeling not quite your best, lay down your burdens and take a rest. And grown, and you've got sorrows more than you've known. It leaves you lonesome and feeling blue. You're not alone, dear, it's not just you.
Excellent, man.
Yeah.
So that was something you wrote, what, as a banjo melody first? Is that kind of what you were trying to illustrate with how the banjo is incorporated into that writing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like it was a melody that I had come up with that I thought was like pretty and like, hey, can we write a song around this? And it like, you know, real broke down where the melody just follows the voice and it kind of stays broke down like that. And it's not characteristic of the band, that's for sure, that we're in. But we write some nice kind of expansive songs, too, that are like that. And so it felt like it wasn't too much of a stretch. And so we actually recorded that one. The project before this, we tried to put it on that record. But it didn't quite fit. We had like a little different treatment to it with the banjo. And Nate and Justin, the fiddle and mandolin player, were like, you know, we think we can kind of write a part to it that would be different, and so that's what ended up in this record, and I really like it. It's the sort of thing people need to hear, you know, that everybody is kind of wandering through this world, not sure where they're headed, and a lot of times things don't go the way you want them to, and you know, you don't have to be alone in it, and really this, for me, a call to arms for people to just support each other, you know?
Yeah, for sure, and definitely delivered in a very digestible way, almost like a Stephen Foster kind of song sounding thing.
Thanks. Yeah.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, I think your main point with your eclecticness was like, I don't know, something like Out of Time, like really right. Caught my ear. It's like, it almost sounds like a Metallica song.
Yeah.
Played
yeah.
on acoustic instruments or something like that.
By elections, by more.
Jay and Ryan. Ryan still collaborates with us a lot. He recorded this last record with us. And those two guys, you know, when we were growing up, they're in a bunch of different metal bands.
Yeah,
that influence is real. And he's always kind of like, you know, he'll bring this to us. And most of the guys in the band, you know, listen to a lot of this music. I think he's come to listen to this music, you know, because we've brought it to him. And we love playing music together. But sometimes he'll be like, you know, I don't know if you guys are going to like this one. And like almost without fail, we're just like, that is an amazing song. We have to figure out how to do that, you know, in this project. So it's fun because it really stretches the sound, you know.
You know, from what I can tell, a lot of the gigs and the festivals you play, you guys get roped into this larger, I guess I'll just call it like the jam grass scene.
Yeah, I think that's probably where people put us. I don't know if that's, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess in a way that's like surprising for an old time-ish band, but do you, like, why do you think that is? Is that the reason that you have these like different sounding tunes, or how would you explain how you've been embraced by this community that might, I don't know, might normally be not associated with like an old time band?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, some of it is, I think we knew about all the hippie festivals before we knew about the bluegrass festivals, you know, like, like that's where all our friends were going. And we're like, hey, we should bring these instruments there.
Yeah. Can we play too?
Yeah. You know, and, I think a lot of it has to do with like how much energy and like, we're trying to be the soundtrack to this evening's party everywhere we go, you know, like, we're not a band that's going to go out and write a set list and is like, we got to play them all the new material. We really want to hear, you know, like we want to keep working on this stuff. You know, it's like, oh, this is a party crowd and they're going to want to dance. And so let's make sure we just play mostly songs that are going to make that happen, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think with a name like ours, it's no wonder so few people have heard of us. And, you know, but like once you see us, I think most people would come back. You know what I mean? Like we are definitely a band to see live. We're just a bunch of friends that have been playing together for 20 years, having the time of our lives still 20 years later, you know? And I think that's a testament to what music can do for you. I feel like it's, you know, it's built this big community and it's yeah. As far as like how we get lumped into that bucket versus another, I guess, I don't know. We've always kind of been like, just put us in as many buckets as you can, you know?
Right. I think you might've hit the nail on the head. Maybe what appeals to the jam grass crowd isn't so much like you need to play 20 minute jams with three finger style banjo and lots of reverb and effects. Maybe it's more just about you seeing you guys have fun and just bringing energy to the to the situation.
Yeah, I think that feels right. Yeah. Yep.
How else would you describe the band? Do you guys improvise a lot, and like where along that spectrum are you?
I mean, I think we're closer to, you know, like a punk rock band. You're going to hear like, you know, 15 songs in a set, not 8, you know. but we do a lot of improvisation. There aren't very many solos or hooks that are like pre-prescribed or written. I mean, there's some, like Jay has a song on this most recent record, Out of Time One, and that's got like this really cool kind of Irish inspired, you know, kind of melody that is a hook that keeps coming back. I think, you know, the improvisation that we do, we probably have a song or two that we get spacey and like, you know, because if that's what the occasion calls for, we can do that. But I wouldn't say it's like something that, whereas with most people, you know, you're going to get a bunch of that at some of the club shows. I think with us, you know, some nights you might not get that at all. And we're not going to, it's not a recipe. We don't play the same set two nights in a row. You know, we just kind of try to keep it fresh. Although I wouldn't know. Yeah. I'm not allowed to write the set lists, which, you know.
I'd be perfectly happy to be not allowed to write the set lists. That's just one of those annoying tasks for me. Like, no, someone else do it. I'll just play whatever.
Yeah. The only risk in that being your approach to life, which is certainly mine, is that there are a lot of shows where I'm like, oh man, I think I'm going to be tuning between every single one of these songs.
Oh yeah.
Did anybody remember that I was here tonight? I don't know. You know, like,
I'm a three-finger player, so I don't deal with quite as many tunings as you do. So everything's just a capo away.
Yeah. I like that. I wish that could happen. Yes. Or just, you know, that we could travel with three banjos, but sometimes one's too many, Keith.
Not for me.
I like it.
Hey, you sort of started to tell us about it, but I'll make you revisit it. The band's setup, like going from one mic to now you said there's two mics, and I imagine there's like some instrument lines happening. Describe what your live setup is, and how do you deal with having one mic or two mics when you have four singers?
Yeah. So we play this rock club in Minneapolis that just recently went out of business, but, or, you know, changed owners or whatever. They're not really a music venue anymore, but it's a big, big roadhouse, 1,100 people or so. And it was really loud place where like guaranteed 50% of the people were not there to hear you on any given night, you know? So we were playing a lot of our early big shows in this room, and like, you know, we were vibey. People were like, have you seen this new local band? And then, you know, we were on this big stage, and the sound guys were really rough around the edges there, but super sweetheart guys. And first or second maybe night that we were there, like one of the guys came up to us and said, you know, great show, guys. That really, it looked like one of the best shows you've ever played. I wish I could have heard anything you did. And the sound guy said that to you.
Okay.
We were just crushed, you know, and he's like, I gave it everything I could, you know, but like, this is a rock club. If this is the type of place you want to play, it is going to be this loud. You know, can you hear how loud it is right now? It was that loud while you were playing, you know? So,
and this is when you were doing, a single mic setup?
Single mic with like a couple of auxiliary solo mics, you know? And it's great for a theater setup. We still, you know, when we can, if we go into a radio, you know, kind of setting, like it's really fun still to do that. But they were just basically like, you know, if you're going to keep doing that in this setting, like, here's the things you should think about, you know? And so the two main things they told us were, you know, plug in your instruments. And we know that that's a big compromise. And, you know, I feel like I spent a decade trying to figure out, like, how can I strike that compromise to play at the volumes we have to while still playing an instrument that's meant to be acoustic and not play that loud. So that was the one big thing that they kind of instilled in us, is everybody's got to figure out how to allow the sound guy to push you up high enough in a setting where the fidelity of the audio is already a lost cause because it's so loud, you know?
So yeah, like, it's already a compromise no matter what.
Yeah. So that was one thing, and we did that, and we kept the large diaphragm to sing around for a while. But that was the first kind of step that we took. And then another, I don't know, 4 or 5 years in, they were like, hey, you guys have gotten really good at singing cheek to cheek. You mix yourselves really well around that one mic. But now that mic is kind of the bottleneck because it's a large diaphragm. You can only turn it up so loud. And they kind of encouraged.
You were still trying to play like rowdy places.
Yeah. And they're like, you know, you should think about SM55, Super 55, because it's got the same capsule as a 58 like this, but it's just in a little wider housing.
And that's the Elvis looking mic, right?
Right. And they're like, you know, you'd have all kinds of headroom with that, and we think it would solve your problems. And we're like, well, we'll try anything once. And we kind of never looked back. We tried it in that room for the first time, and the vocals were suddenly popping through, which is, you know, we do a lot of harmony singing, you know, and we just love that aspect of it. So I think that's like, as far as our live setup, that's a pretty big thing for us, is just like how we've had to kind of figure out the sound reinforcement to be able to play in places that are as loud as they are.
And so the solution that you came up with and what you still do is like two 55s?
Yeah, we started with just one. Yeah, right now there's two. We started with just one 55. But then through COVID, you know, for a little bit, everybody's like required, like whether we wanted to or not, to have their own mic on stage, because everybody had to like stay apart if the show, there was some of that. And then that was over, but we were like, well, that was, there was some part of that that was nice for the vocals, you know, to mix better when you're not just mixing yourself spatially around one mic and it's that loud. And so we were like, well, what if we kind of compromise? I think we had seen, we had just recently, like the year before, seen the McCurrys do that, Del McCurry Band do that. And we were like, oh, that's really nice. Look at that. Del's got his own mic, you know, as he should. And so we were like, well, we could maybe do that. And they do it with large diaphragms, but we just decided to do it with those two Super 55s.
Is there a system in terms of the lead singer goes on this mic and backing vocals go on this other mic? Or what's the...
Or there's just like a stage right and stage left mic. And for the most part, like there's two main singers that are on stage right and two main singers that are on stage left. And so if one of those singers is leading, they sing in front of that mic. And then if there's somebody on their side of the stage that's singing backup, you know, you go over to the other mic.
They go to the other side. Got it.
So we try to like whichever one is the main mic, we try to do, you know, when we can. And some of the songs just doesn't work because they're too, you know, there's like callbacks or, you know, there's five of us singing, you know, so then we just kind of gang vocal it still. But
yeah, everything's just out the window at that point. Just sing at a mic if they're, So what about your personal setup? You already mentioned how it's notoriously difficult to take this acoustic instrument and make it loud. What is your current setup to do that?
I feel like I've tried everything, but maybe current setup is probably the right thing to say, because maybe I'll keep fiddling with it. Let's see. I use the Felix 2 from Grace Designs. And that's really nice that with the two kind of independent channels. So I send like one channel, you know, that's from a Beta 98, I think, that's zip tied inside the banjo. And then I've got a Schotten DI, which is like a underbridge DI. I super glued under the middle foot of the head. And then I send the sound guy two clean channels, you know, one of the mic and one of the piezo. And I just, you know, kind of come up with my little spiel that I tell them, you know, neither one of them sounds good independently. One of them sounds really bad independently. But if you like work really hard on EQing each single independently and bring them together, they magically start to sound like a banjo.
And you've found that allowing the sound guy to do that rather than blending them on board yourself tends to work better.
I don't think any of those are good solutions, honestly. And so without traveling with our own sound guy, I think I have tended to just decide to like let the person do their best at tuning in the room. I am wireless. So like if I'm hearing from stage, like it's like, I don't know what's going on here. Then I will like get off and like walk out and like, you know, play a little bit out there and like try to give some guidance if it's needed. But you know, like the mic is just really warm. It gives a lot of the kind of, it's almost like to the extent of being muddy if it's not brightened up. So it needs a lot of EQ help to, you know, kind of bring out the brightness out of the mic. And then the piezo sounds just terrible. I mean, it's like very tinny, you know?
I've had one of those, it's
pretty... really like, you know, and then I tell them if you use like 30% of this and, you know, 70% of the mic, because you get from the, even if that piezo is sounding really harsh, you get a lot of nice like attack. It does like beef up the sound a little bit, which is can get a little washed with the mic.
Yeah, in a loud environment, that's just where your bass volume comes from. It's having that. What about the banjo itself? What are you playing?
I have two Bart Ryder standards. So he's a maker from your home state there.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's really made some great banjos. I don't think he's making them anymore, but there's still a lot of them around. And he, like I had said before, Nate, the mandolin player, worked at a guitar shop, and he's like, hey, we got this new open back in, and you know, you should come check it out. And I immediately fell in love with this standard, and I bought it, and eventually I sent it back to Bart, and he scooped out the neck for me. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to order another one of these then. So I got two of them, And I tried for a long time to travel with both of them because all the tuning and stuff, and I'd have one in double C and one in open G. I mean, I just never liked how they, I felt like they didn't sound similar enough, even though they were like, you know, 400 apart or whatever in terms of like how, where he made them in the history of his banjos. And like, they just didn't, you know, I would like get the drum head tuner out and like be trying to like, okay, everything is like 88 pounds or whatever everywhere, you know. Now they're going to sound the same. And we go out on the road and they just wouldn't ever sound enough alike for me to not feel like the sound guy would have to like make some EQ adjustments between the two.
Okay.
But I still have
more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah. It felt like it. I don't know if that was just me saying that or if it really was, but.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Anything else that you're particular about in terms of like types of strings, type of bridge, head? You already mentioned that you switched to the, what, Kirshner tailpiece?
Yep, Kirshner tailpiece. Yep. And then I use Rick Sampson's reclaimed wood bridges. He's got a bunch. He's a Wisconsin maker, and he gets a bunch of old growth wood out of Lake Superior. So it's like submerged wood. It's really nice stuff. And he's a nice guy. I really like his bridges, and he's a Renaissance head, and I use the GHS Almost Medium strings. So
nice. And you mentioned like an 88 on the drum dial. Is that actually the number that you
I stopped paying attention to that when I stopped traveling with both banjos, but I kind of, you know, do it by feel more than anything now. But I did, you know, I was trying to be really serious about it because I was like, that must be the variable that's off and I can figure out how to control that. And I don't know.
Well, especially because Bart is probably like one of the most consistent
builders. They look, you couldn't tell that they were not exactly the same. I mean, what a legacy. Those are amazing banjos.
Yep. Totally agree. Anything else to say about either your playing, or we kind of brushed on the new album. When did that new album come out? It's called Waiting Days.
It's called Waiting Days. Yeah. It came out in October.
So that's brand new.
Yeah. Yep. And we're really excited about it. It's, our last record came out like right in the middle of the pandemic, you know. I think everything closed down in like March, and we had a record in the can ready to go that was slated for release in June.
Yeah.
And we were like, do we hold it or do we just go? And then, you know, we're like, let's go. How long could this take? And everybody knows how that story ended. So, you know, we released a record 3 months into the pandemic. And so this is the first one since that. And, you know, we were just really excited to get the new music out there and tour around it, which has been really fun. Yeah, Waiting Days is an interesting song, too. I have the pleasure of singing a lot of songs that Nate has written over the years. And that's another one.
Let's take a long drive out to the country and look at the color on the leaves. Radio is singing everything on my mind, and my mind is singing sweet. Our waiting days are finally over. My mind keeps pulling down the road. Oh yes, it's that time of year again. Get out of here, my friend. I wanna take you with me.
But he and I, a while ago, had collaborated with this this director and this actor and another musician friend of ours, and had written some music for a play, and performed in the play for a little bit anyway. And one of the songs that Nate had written for the play was a version of this Waiting Days song. And so sometimes I think about like all the different lives that song has had.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, that it was an interesting play too. It's the only time I've ever played a banjo with nylon strings. So, you know, through this like 6 month run or whatever it was that we were working on it, I was using whatever those black nylon strings are, which are really nice.
Was there something about the play? Was it supposed to be like a Shakespearean era thing that that the nylon strings was more appropriate or what?
Yeah, it was like themed on the book Moby Dick. So it was like, And it was just too loud compared to the other instruments without that modification okay. too, but it also was more period appropriate probably too.
Nice. And how do you guys record? It strikes me that, you know, for an old time band that even on stage just kind of gangs around these two mics, what's your studio approach like? Similar?
Somewhat similar. We've recorded a lot of different ways. We've definitely recorded things live. On this last record, I don't think anything was recorded live on this last record. I think like all the foundation tracks are recorded like live together in a room, you know, and you're like, mm-hmm. we kind of often will leave, you know, space to track in solos and track in the vocals later. That's probably our most typical approach. Kind of the most efficient approach, I guess, as we've found over the years. And we've been working a lot with Ryan Young, who was our original fiddle player, like I mentioned, and he's got a studio in Crystal. And so like, you know, just like a old friend still collaborating with, you know, he did our first bunch of records and he's done our last bunch of records too. We worked with somebody else kind of in the middle for a while, but it's been really fun. Just like
a good, comfortable situation. Yeah.
Able to be really,
that's great.
You know, creative and explore stuff and know that you can trust this, you know, friend of yours to be like, that's a bad idea, you know, or like, oh, that's cool. You know, like,
right.
Know? So anyway,
Anything else to say about your banjo style or anything else that we should know about your story before we close up here?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like, I've taken a bunch of lessons, but I'd say I'm mostly self-taught. Like, I feel like I know a lot of clawhammer players who'd be like, oh, I play round peak style, or I play, you know, like they've got some real specific like regional influence. And, you know, I feel like my biggest influence has been trying to figure out how to play clawhammer banjo, like in this band, you know, to make it fit. Cause I was already there. I wasn't going anywhere else, you know? and so like, you know, I've been a real fan of a lot of different kinds of clawhammer players over the years. Like even here in the Midwest, there's a band called Horseshoes and Hand Grenades out of Wisconsin. Sure. And there's the banjo player there, his name is Russ. And, you know, he's my favorite banjo player, you know, like I could listen to him all day and night, you know. It's just fun to like, I feel like there's just a big community of people here. And yeah, as far as my style, I don't know. I hope I have a style.
It sounds like you're making your own style. It's the custom, you know, Pertinier Sandstone style.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it really comes down to in old time music anyway, I feel like it comes down to like oftentimes like the fiddle player you're playing with and the tunes that you're playing together and like, you know, what the source of those tunes are. And like with YouTube and stuff these days, it's so easy to be like, oh man, there's this great recording of Brad Leftwich, you know, who's another great musician out of the Midwest, and you know he's playing this tune, and we should do this tune. I love this tune, and so then everybody goes home and does the homework, and we figure it out how we're gonna play it together. You know, it just feels like it's music that's already notoriously the most accessible has become even more accessible. You know, as far as like folk and acoustic music in general.
Yeah, it kind of makes it so those regional styles that you talked about, it kind of blurs the lines now that everyone can hear what's going on everywhere else.
Yeah.
I wonder if the regional styles might fall away for better or worse.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, there's still some things that I feel like, you know, that where even today you can see that, though, you know, like, do you remember the band Split Lip Rayfield?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Your skin falls off.
They were just like this massive influence in Kansas and way beyond. But like in Kansas, it was interesting. Like when we were a band in Minnesota and then like touring up, you know, to Kansas where we knew these guys were from, like, you felt like when you had an opening band that's from the area, like, I wonder how much like Split Lip they're gonna sound. And oftentimes it was a lot like Split Lip, like, you know, just wow, this foot stomping, like they have a very Kansas kind of style. I don't know, there's like another great band called the Calamity Cubes and Dakar Sana and all these bands that were like around that region at the time that I feel like had this vibe. And you know, I feel like in the Midwest, a lot of people will be like, oh, a lot of these bands sound like Trampled by Turtles, because they have a very like prominent sound in the Midwest, and I think have influenced a lot of people and a lot of people's sounds. And, you know, Yonders certainly like has had this huge impact on like what the Colorado sound is. And a lot of those jamgrass bands now that are like, you know,
everything's come from Yonder. Yeah.
Yeah.
From,
you know,
pretty much.
Yeah.
In Michigan here, there's like a lot of us wonder if there's Darwin's the finches on Galapagos Island thing happening, because Michigan's surrounded by lakes. And so not a lot of touring bands come up into Michigan. Mm. And a lot of us just play in the state.
Yeah, yeah.
So we kind of wonder if we're just evolving our own little ecosystem here.
Yeah, yeah, that's cool.
We have, you know, we have great musicians here.
Yeah.
We, you know, they're everywhere, of course.
Yeah.
But
Green Sky.
Interesting stuff.
It comes from there, right? And
Green Sky, Billy,
yeah.
Lindsay. Yeah.
Lindsay. Oh, man.
Tons of
people.
Man,
we just saw Lindsay. She is so good.
I was in her band when she was in Michigan.
Oh,
I was
awesome.
Real, real proud of all those folks. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, really interesting to see all that. Yeah.
Drop some websites, man. How do people check you out?
Oh, yeah.
And find your tour dates and your recordings?
Yeah, we're at PertNearSandstone.com. PertNearSandstone on the Instas, and I think on the Twitters too, or we might be PertNearMusic there. I don't know. And now it's X anyway, so whatever. I don't know if any of that matters these days. But yeah, we're out there on the interwebs for sure.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Well, great chatting with you. Great meeting you, and hope to see you around sometime.
Yeah,
I know you're coming to Michigan in February.
We are, yeah.
You're coming to the part of Michigan that's like 11 hours away from where I am.
Oh, man.
It seems impossible that anywhere in my state should be 11 hours away.
That's amazing. Yeah, we go this way to get there, you know? We don't go this way.
I know you do.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, cool, man.
Well, hey, man. Great talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
That's going to wrap up this episode of the Picky Fingers Banjo Podcast. You did hear some song clips in this episode, and I have to say, these are the most interesting titles for song clips of any episode thus far. Check it out. In order, they were I've Been Traveling by PertNear Sandstone, Ain't It a Shame to Whip Your Wife on Sunday by the New Lost City Ramblers, Hawks Got a Chicken and Flew in the Woods by the Wilders, Sally Ann by High on the Hog, Cumberland Gap by Doc Boggs, Seeds of the Pine by Martha Scanlon, Out of Time, and then Waiting Days, both by PertNear Sandstone, and then finally, The High Price of Necromancy by Split Lip Rayfield. Thank you once again to Tom Donovan. He's today's VIP Patreon supporter of the show. Become a supporter yourself. Go to patreon.com/banjopodcast. Throw in a few dollars to keep this show up and running. Get your Picky Fingers merch over at banjopodcast.com. Drop me a line, pickyfingersbanjopodcast@gmail.com. That's going to do it for me, folks. I'll see you all next time.
Banjo player, I guess they don't trust me for anything, you know.